So tonight I'm going to read and talk about and comment on a commentary by a very well-known Zen master, died in 1970. He was born in 1885, died in 1970. It's actually, if we were to view this school of Zen as part of a lineage, and we'll go into that a little bit, he would be kind of our grandfather, great-grandfather. And his name is Hakuun Yasutani. So Yasutani Roshi is really very well known in the United States. And he, there's a translation of his commentaries by a person whose name I don't recall yet, but I'll read it, I'll find it for you. And the name of the book here is Flowers Fall. So it's a commentary on Zen Master Dogen's Genjo Koan. And we're going to go into all of this. I may end up making this kind of a series. We'll just see how it goes. I don't like to pin myself down too much with these Teisho, but I think there's so much in this book that it might be useful from time to time to look into it, maybe in order, not jumping around, but in order. So I just want to start with some background on this. So this Dogen, as you know, is one of the founders of the last of the two remaining branches of Zen. The two remaining branches are Rinzai, and the other is Soto. Now, as they have evolved through the ages into the present moment, they've become quite opposite each other. And that's useful to us here, because one of the beauties of Dogen's writings, and once again, he was one of the founders of the Soto school, is that he was a master dialectician. He was able to really see and discuss and expose this one thing, which you would call the Buddha Dharma, through two almost opposite sides of it. You might say the absolute and the relative. Emptiness versus no self. So we're going to go into this. So that is really the beauty of this Genjo Koan, which is the very first chapter of his masterwork called the Shobogenzo. So Dogen was viewed as one of the most brilliant, philosophically speaking, Zen masters. He was born in the 1200s, so he's a 13th century Zen master. And he wrote this long and intricate and deep and profound text called the Shobogenzo. And the very first section of the Shobogenzo is the section on which this commentary by Yasutani Roshi is dealing with. And that section is called Genjo Koan. We'll go into that too. So this is Dogen. At one time, back in the Tang Dynasty and then the following dynasty, the Sung Dynasty, there were actually up to five separate schools of Zen. Now, they were all interrelated. They worked from the same basic texts, but their approaches were slightly different, and they came about through different lineages, just the splitting of the lineages from the time of Bodhidharma through the remaining five Zen patriarchs and then into the many Chinese Zen masters. This was in China, it was called Chan Buddhism. It became Zen when it was brought over to Japan. And because that word was very simple, three letters, easy to pronounce, it stuck. When Zen Buddhism came to the United States. And one of the folks who helped it really establish deeply in the United States was the author of this commentary, Yasutani Roshi. So now, just to go into Yasutani Roshi's role in this, what had boiled down from the Tang Dynasty of five schools of Zen to what we now have as two schools of Zen, Rinzai and Soto, Yasutani Roshi was kind of a third rail. He was initially brought up in the Soto tradition. Now I'll just say a little bit about Soto. Soto is the school of Zen that emphasizes a particular kind of Zazen, which is often viewed as the, and I'll put very big air quotes around it, highest form of Zazen. And this form of Zazen is called Shikan Taza. I hope that at some point along the way of my association with all of you that I will be able to instruct you personally in Shikan Taza. It's a wonderful form of Zazen. The way that it is taught in the Soto school, it is actually sitting in a manner that manifests your intrinsic original Buddha nature. And because you are so clearly manifesting it, you're not seeking for it. So there's no seeking in this form of Zazen. There's no aiming for anything in particular, particularly not any sudden experience, which could be called enlightenment or Kensho. This is now the Soto teaching of Shikan Taza. And it's done with great faith that since Buddha nature is intrinsic to all beings and you're a being, you fully have it, you fully manifest it, and through the devoted sitting in this state of Shikan Taza, you are not only actualizing, expressing, shining this Buddha nature, but you will eventually come gradually to fully realize it and manifest it. So Shikan Taza, you know, just to put it very simply, is just sitting. It has no particular object. The word Shikan Taza is actually three Japanese words. Shikan, ta, and za. So shikan is just, ta is hit, and za is sit, as in zazen. So it's just sit, hit, just hit, sit. So what it means is just intense sitting. That's how I translate it, just intense sitting. It's not soporific. It's not resting on your laurels as a intrinsic Buddha who now just needs to sit there and emanate. It's a very intense form of Zazen that has no particular focal point other than the flow of your actual sensations from moment to moment. And because of that, it is difficult for people starting out in Zazen to do it properly. And it can easily, even in old practitioners, people who've been sitting for a long time, deteriorate into a kind of a dull state, something called dead sitting. Just sort of sitting there like a lump on a log. Nothing's happening, you're not going anywhere. Some people describe that as soaking stones in water. You know, as long as they soak in this water, they're stones, they're not going to pick up any water. Nothing's going to be gained. And this will be kind of a blind alley. So this is Shikan Taza. Now, Yasutani Roshi was initially trained in Soto. And he was trained at a time when Soto had really deteriorated into a kind of a more intellectual, it was the intellectual side of Zen, it was considered the highest form of Zen. It is the main form of Zen, even nowadays practiced in Japan. And probably outside of this third rail that Yasutani Roshi propagated, the most common form of Zen practiced in the United States. Rinzai Zen, conversely, started with Master Rinzai and progressed through his successors and gradually became kind of stale, and it deteriorated too. It is a school that puts great emphasis on awakening and utilizes koan practice in order to break through into awakening and then deepen that awakening. And there are many, many koan. In the training of a Rinzai monk, that monk may go through as many as 1,500 or more koan and sub-koan and parts of koan and capping phrases. So it's a very elaborate system. It requires very close work between the master and the student. And it's a very vigorous form of Zen. And because it puts strong emphasis on awakening, it has, through the years, produced many very deeply awakened masters. But unfortunately, became rote as time went on. The masters that had genuine enlightenment became more and more rare. And there were many that just had an intellectual understanding of koans, and there was a certain stale, staid way of having the answer to the koan. Certain demonstrations were accepted, rubber stamped, and the students became just as kind of stuck in a rut as their teachers were, until this great Zen master, Rinzai Zen master. I believe he was in the 1600s. His name was Hakuin. And Hakuin renovated this Rinzai Zen. He was greatly enlightened, wonderful personality, deeply compassionate human being, intelligent, forthright, a poet, an artist. And he rejuvenated Rinzai Zen. And it has come quite a way from that very stale period. Although it's still a smaller school of Zen in the world as a pure school. So we have this Rinzai and Soto. Now Yasutani Roshi was very uncompromising. He rejected the teachers in the Soto school that he had studied under and the writings that he had read as being just lifeless. They weren't emphasizing or even trying for or even believing in the reality of awakening, which he saw as a fundamental aspect of Buddhist practice, because the Buddha himself underwent a deep awakening experience, and this was how Buddhism began, and the Buddha taught this throughout his tenure as a teacher, for the 40 years he taught. And yet, in Japan, something had gone stale in this Soto lineage. So Yasutani Roshi, despairing of finding any valid master in the Soto school, began to branch out and look for Rinzai teachers, even though he was brought up in his family with Soto Zen, and began to work with koan, and eventually met up with a really wonderful, he was also Soto master, but he used koan and emphasized Kensho and awakening, and his name was Harada Roshi, Dayun Harada Roshi, who was, if you were to view what we're doing here as part of a lineage, he would be like our great grandfather, great great grandfather. I haven't actually worked it out in this particular Living Dharma Center lineage. So Harada Roshi was a great master, wonderful master, who had already begun to merge the Soto and Rinzai schools into this third rail, which they called Sambo Kyodan. Sambo Kyodan. It's neither Soto nor Rinzai. I think the translation of Sambo Kyodan is the three jewels. And the three jewels in Buddhism are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So it was a new approach which emphasized koan practice early on, and after some period of working with koan and breaking through, introduced as a way of deepening one's insight shikantaza. So one would both do shikantaza and koan practice. Now, there were some students who just couldn't resonate with koan at all, and they would do shikantaza. But the style of shikantaza taught in this third rail of Zen is very intense and penetrating. It's the kind of shikantaza I teach. Now, how did it come up to this present moment before we launch into the book, which we may not even have time to do tonight, but we'll see if we have time to enter it. So, Harada Roshi was a Zen master under whom Yasutani Roshi practiced. And after 2 years, he had done much practice before meeting up with Harada Roshi, but after 2 years, he had quite a good breakthrough, Kensho, Satori, enlightenment experience, and continued to work with Harada Roshi and some other masters until he finally really, after another 10 years, matured his insight and was then allowed through something called Inca, which is the full transmission of the right to teach and the recognition of someone's deep awakening, he became a teacher on his own. Now, Yasutani Roshi was a character. He was very outspoken. He would point out faults in teachings and teachers. He was not hesitant to do that. There was also controversy about him. He was intensely nationalistic, and during World War II, he, of course, as many Zen masters did, took the side of Japan in the war, felt that Japan was right, the rest of the world was wrong. He also espoused anti-Semitic views, which is when this came out many years ago, say 15, 20 years ago this came out, and was extremely distressing for Zen students in the United States and around the world, and particularly those in this particular lineage, to know that at some point in time he harbored these views and espoused them. And it was very hard to put this together with what we knew to be a quite deeply awakened Zen master and a wonderful teacher who himself had no interest in being the head of a monastery and teaching only monks, and really focused on teaching laypersons in Japan, and then eventually was brought over to the United States where he taught laypersons here. And one of his students, who actually met him in Japan, having gone over to Japan after serving as a court reporter in the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II, when the Nazis and the Japanese war machine was brought to task and various sentences were meted out. He was a court reporter. His name was Philip Kaplow. Philip Kaplow actually had a Jewish mother. He was Jewish. And he felt extremely distressed by what he observed in the Nuremberg trials as a reporter, and felt quite burned out by the end of it. Had ulcers, headaches, couldn't sleep, probably was very depressed. Just couldn't get his life sorted out, and all the things that he thought would give his life meaning seemed flat and worthless and stupid and pointless. And somehow, during this period of time in the 1950s, I believe, early 1950s, I think it was 1951, he tripped over Zen, as all of us in this room tripped over it. We weren't born with a Zen book in our hand. He tripped over it and realized that this is what he'd been searching for. And he decided he was going to pull the pin on this hand grenade and go to Japan. And he was going to find himself a master and happened to initially study with Yasutani Roshi's master, Harada Roshi, and spent 5 very hard years with Harada Roshi in a traditional monastery. And after that, felt he couldn't continue in the monastery. He had had some insights, but didn't feel he had thoroughly broken through. And he was referred to this teacher of lay people, where he could kind of back out of the very intense environment, the harsh environment of a Japanese Zen monastery, extremely harsh, militaristic, hard practice. He could back off a little bit, be more of a regular person, and study under Yasutani Roshi, who was a successor of Harada Roshi. And under Yasutani Roshi, he had a very deep awakening and was eventually given permission to go back to the United States and teach, where he set up the Rochester Zen Center. And he was my very first Zen teacher about 40-plus years ago. So he set up the Rochester Zen Center. Yasutani Roshi would occasionally come out and visit and run sesshin there and in other locations in the United States. And just by chance, around the time I was at Rochester Zen Center, I only lived there for 2 or 3 weeks in a work-study program, and then did 3 sesshin there over a 2-year period, during which time I was Phil Kaplow's student and an avid reader of his famous book, The Three Pillars of Zen, which just, to me, was like the Bible. And just by chance, I probably was quite close to a person who was there as well, but didn't meet him until long afterwards. And this person, who was also a student of Phil Kaplow's, was Richard Clark. Now, Richard Clark is the founder of the Living Dharma Center. He started the Living Dharma Center back in the early 60s. It was originally Sharon Springs. So he, after 13 years of working with Philip Kaplow and having deep awakenings, one of which is actually described in a second book by Philip Kaplow, Zen Dawn in the West, is Richard Clark's awakening experience is described there as a first-person account. And about 2 years after that awakening, Richard had an even more profound awakening, something you might call full awakening. So one of the things that even this book goes into is the many levels of awakening. Awakening is not a once-and-done event. Usually a first awakening is shallow. It fades. It doesn't often dramatically change one's life as old habit patterns return. And that can be very distressing to students. They begin to feel like maybe their enlightenment wasn't valid, and maybe the teacher is a fraud, and they begin to doubt the whole process. So it's very important for students starting out to know that there will be these quantum leaps in insight. You could call them Kensho or just call them understanding a particular koan. Doesn't matter what you call it, but it is really an endless process. It's endlessly deepened. And in this process of deepening, there are times when there is a sudden deepening. And we might call those Satori, awakening, enlightenment, Kensho, whatever you want. But Richard, 2 years after his first Kensho, had an even deeper Kensho. He described this to me, because I worked with Richard for 30 years. I should say that after spending 2 years with Kaplow, I actually was invited to spend a year in a monastery. This was a strict Rinzai monastery in the mountains of LA, and I studied under a Japanese, traditional Japanese Rinzai master, Sasaki Roshi, for a year. It was very hard practice. And after that, returned to my home in Massachusetts and continued to study under Sasaki Roshi for several more years and a couple of other Roshi until I met Richard Clark in 1983. After finishing my residency in family medicine, I came back to the Amherst area, and Richard happened to be running the Living Dharma Center in Amherst. So along the course of my long training with Richard Clark, which lasted about 30 years, and the last 10 of it was very, very close and intimate, he shared this awakening experience he had. I can tell you that he had a profound insight while sitting in a sesshin at Rochester Zen Center under the tutelage of Philip Kaplow. And I remember the Rochester Zen Center from my own experience there as having a Dokusan line at the foot of a flight of stairs. And the Roshi's room was at the top of the stairs. And you would wait in this line of three or four sitters, and then there were bells rung, and then eventually you would ascend the staircase, heart pounding, almost many times for me in a total panic, knowing what a profound teacher Philip Kaplow was and how he could probably, I believe, see through me like a pane of glass. So Richard rang the bell and couldn't get himself up the stairs. He was so overwhelmed by this experience he had, weeping profoundly. He said that as he was ascending the stairs, these words were booming through his mind. There's only one thing, there's only one thing. He was brought up by others, helped up the stairs, entered the Dokusan room, and his full awakening was confirmed. And at that point, Philip Kaplow took off his own rakusu and put it over the head of Richard Clark. And Richard took this to be a living, valid transmission, an acknowledgement of his awakening. And so this is why Richard always felt that he was part of this lineage. Although later, Philip Kaplow, in a sense, disowned Richard. The reasons for that I'm not clear about. Part of it was that Richard didn't want to continue to work under Philip Kaplow and his monks there at Rochester. He had gone to Sharon Springs and broke out on his own, and he wanted to continue teaching on his own. There may have been other factors that I'm not aware of. But because Philip Kaplow disowned Richard, if you look in various records of lineage, he's not listed. Therefore, I would not be considered part of that lineage. Do I care? No. Richard was an amazing, wonderful, profound teacher. There are many broken lineages throughout the history of Zen and currently in the United States and other parts of the world. So that's really part of Zen, this myth of unbroken lineage from the time of the Buddha. Perhaps at one time that was true, but it's kind of gotten more of a myth status than anything else. So that brings us to the present moment here, where we are actually continuing to practice in this tradition that was really brought to fruition by Yasutani Roshi, brought to the United States by Philip Kaplow, and further evolved by Richard Clark. And I can tell you how that evolved, because I experienced it directly under Philip Kaplow at Rochester Zen Center, which was a very hard place, very intense. And one of the criticisms of Yasutani Roshi and Harada Roshi and Sambo Kyodan is what some people consider an overemphasis on awakening, an overemphasis on Kensho, to the point of creating pressure cooker-like conditions for students to help them push beyond any inner barrier of laziness, holding back, holding on to some image of a self, in order to propel them suddenly into the state of awakening. And then the awakening itself would often have a big deal made over it. So in these sesshin by Yasutani Roshi, they were very, very intense. The kyosaku stick rained down. People would be shouting mu in the zendo. There would be a great feeling of intensity. And sometimes three, four, five people at a given sesshin would experience kensho. And then after the sesshin was over, they'd have a ceremony to recognize the people who had kensho, which would only further prod on and perhaps create some intense jealousy among those who didn't have kensho. So this was a real pressure cooker. And Rochester Zen Center, perhaps it wasn't quite as bad as in Japan or other places, but it was intense. I can remember one sesshin I went to there, a seven-day sesshin, where 54 people attended. It was so big that the main zendo was full, and they had to open up what they call an auxiliary zendo, which was a separate room, and I was in that room. And I remember before every sitting, the energy was so intense, it was so crackling in the air, that I felt literally like I might levitate off my cushions. I mean this. It was that intense. It took me at least 5 or 10 minutes just to settle down enough to do zazen. That's how intense the energy was. The kyusaku stick rained down. I developed these open sores, bleeding sores in my shoulders. And it was a really, really intense session. Now, for better or worse, I don't regret having experienced that approach to Zen practice, but I am so grateful that I met Richard Clark and that he already began, not completely, softening the approach, realizing that this intense and militaristic approach may have had certain positive side effects, but many negative ones as well. Kind of egotistical, hard, judgmental, seeking, attached, desiring approach to awakening. And it's as if the Soto side of this amalgam between Soto Zen and Rinzai Zen had gotten a bit set aside, and the Rinzai side was overemphasized. So I was very fortunate to have crossed paths with Richard Clark, who greatly softened, and near the end of his life, he died in 2013, at that point asked me to continue for him. I have continued to soften it. I was a victim of the hard practice for many years, had such a hard practice myself that it really interfered with my ability to do zazen. And I don't want any students to have to go through that. There's no need for it. It's unnecessary. It's superfluous. So that brings us to the present moment of this book, Flowers Fall. We haven't had a chance to enter it, but we've laid down the framework for it. And perhaps the next Teisho I give will start to enter this book, you know, armed with the knowledge that I shared with you. And we'll start to enter this viewpoint of Yasutani Roshi as he looks upon the writings of one of the greatest Soto Zen masters ever, Zen Master Dogen. So we'll end there tonight.